Hello and welcome to the Humanising Health and Care podcast, brought to you by the Point of Care Foundation. In this episode, Katie talks with Patrick and Rhiannon about their experience using experience-based co-design as a method for improving services at the North East London NHS Foundation Trust. Thank you for downloading, and we hope you enjoy.
Hi, I'm Rhiannon Haag, and I'm clinical lead for the Adult Speech and Language Therapy team. In Nelft.
I'm Patrick.
Hi, my name is Patrick Onyema. I'm an advanced quality improvement practitioner with the quality improvement team here at Nelft.
And I'm Katie Campion. I'm the patient experience programs lead. And we are going to talk today about EBCD, experience-based co-design, and a particular project that Rhiannon and Patrick were involved in. And I'd like to know, first of all, kind of how it started. How did you hear about EBCD or think about using that as a method?
So for Maren from the QI team, my colleague, my manager, her name's Claire, she was on the EBCD training. She attended one of the workshops in the training. And when I joined the team, she told me, oh, I've got a lot of resource around co-production. If you were interested, because when I joined the team, I said I was really interested in working in partnership with people who use services. And she said, I got just the right resource for you. She gave me that resource pack. So I went through it and I put out a tweet one day on Twitter saying, look, anyone who's in Nelft, we've got this EBCD co-production framework. I would like to try out, to test out. And guess who indicated interest? And I'll let Rhi take off from there.
Yeah, so we'd been working through some changes during COVID for people who've had a laryngectomy. So that's, for anyone who doesn't know, it typically happens around cancer, where the voice box is removed permanently. And then you have a permanent neck stoma. And speech and language therapists are involved supporting patients throughout the rest of their life after this. And we always carried out the clinic in a hospital setting pre-COVID. And then when COVID came, outpatients were closed. And the advice was not to see people face-to-face if you could at the time, because it was aerosol generating, you were going inside the trachea and things like that. But obviously, we were going to have to look at seeing them face to face eventually. There were going to be more risks to not doing. And there were then issues around the room that we'd previously used, around its suitability for aerosol generating procedures. And so we really had to start thinking outside the box. And at the same time, our patients were saying that they didn't feel comfortable going into big hospitals because they were vulnerable in terms of COVID. And they really wanted a local setup. And so we developed a domiciliary service, which in terms of it being so comprehensive, it was the first of its kind. So there are other teams that have done one-offs to people at home, but this was a blanket. Everybody has a domiciliary service. And that had been really, really positively received by our patients. We'd taken anonymous surveys after every appointment that we'd done, and the feedback was overwhelming from that. They were really, really positive and wanted to retain the domiciliary service. And there were also little bits of things that had happened that were really positive that you thought, oh, this is really different to how we'd worked before, and this could be really beneficial. It's a one-off at the moment, but maybe we could work on this. So we'd found ourselves doing joint visits with district nursing, with older adults' mental health, with palliative care teams, delivering interventions during palliative stages that we would never would have done before, because if the person couldn't have come into hospital, we wouldn't have delivered that sort of service. And so there were all these things that you're thinking, we could really work on this, or the transition from hospital to home, and the difference of seeing someone in their own home at that stage of their care. And so we really wanted to sort of investigate it more. But I think we'd involved our patients so much up until that point that we really wanted to do it through engaging them and finding out from them. It was their voice that was saying so strongly, we want to keep this, we don't want to go back to the hospital, that made me go, okay, we need some way of working with them. This is a QI project or several QI projects, but we need to get them involved, and I don't quite know how to go about doing that. I don't quite have the skill set. And then at that point, Patrick was reaching out and I said, yes, we'll be guinea pigs.
Brilliant. So then what happened next?
There was a mini sort of survey around co-production, and you know, in general, and not a lot of people knew what it was.
Mm.
So we thought, if we're going to be working with a team on using the EBCD framework, let's pull together a short presentation on co-production for staff, just to get them thinking about what this is all about and how we can introduce the experience-based core design from the point of care into that mix. Mm. So we did like a short 30-minute presentation. But for every step of the way, for everything we did, we took feedback from staff, from users of services, just for our learning and for us to know, okay, this worked, what are we going to try next time? And then, as I said, we did several meetings as a project team. We started to work through our stakeholder analysis, start to put things into power and influence. And interestingly, the traditional sort of stakeholder analysis will put patients as or users of services at a different place. But as we started to think co-production, experience-based co-design, we started to move that power and influence up. And we started to have conversation about, actually, what would really be nice is to have the person with lived experience as part of the project team. So right from the start, we're already starting to learn different aspects.
So for anyone listening, EBCD is a staged approach to patient-centered quality improvement. And the first half is experience gathering. So you do observations and you interview staff and patients. And then the second half of the cycle is co-design, where you're actually working in partnership with patients or with their families. And what we quite often hear is that it's really helpful to have a thorough kind of staged method, because actually involving patients as partners can feel quite threatening, and you're not really sure kind of how to do that or how to contain that. How did it go in terms of gathering the experiences? So it sounds like you worked really hard on engagement and the stakeholder mapping, which is really important. And sometimes when people miss those steps, you can get partway through and then actually there's key stakeholders that haven't been involved. So it sounds like that went really, really well. And maybe because of that really good partnership between Rhiannon's team and the QI team. How was the experience gathering? So interviewing staff and patients.
We anticipated some kind of resistance, not in a negative way, but people's quest to want to know more. So we chose ourselves to interview staff because we didn't want someone who was part of the laryngectomy service to do the interview, because then we could ask what you call silly questions.
Mm.
But what we did was to look through those questions and sort of rearrange them, added some bits into it that suited the service and the sort of care that it provided. And just to hear staff talk about things that are positive about the care that they delivered was refreshing. A lot of the time, most people start from the negatives, what's not working well. And I thought that was really nice to start with what was working well for staff. And sometimes when I interviewed staff and I asked them, can you just reflect on that for a second? You think that you deliver one of the best services in the United Kingdom. I said, have you ever taken the time to actually take that in? You know, they share their own journey, their motivations for doing the role. So staff were quite engaged, they were very engaging. They answered all the questions. They were happy for us to write their responses and make notes.
Yeah, so with the patient interviews, obviously, for similar to what Patrick had said, we were looking for someone from outside the service to take those interviews, particularly because the service is very specialist. So there's only a few staff members who have the training to be delivering it. And we see people for the rest of their lives. So there are people who I've known for 10, 15 years. And so you have a very strong clinical relationship with people. And then for them to feel comfortable sitting in front of you, and what you want to do is for them to pull out, yes, the things that go well, but you want them to really say what could be better and where things have gone wrong. And I'm not convinced that they would have necessarily felt comfortable sitting in front of me or my colleagues saying, oh, well, this didn't work so well, or that didn't work so well. So you want them to have that freedom to feel that they can just speak openly. So we were looking for that outside person again, but we definitely didn't have the staffing within QI team or within our team or anywhere to actually deliver that. So we started thinking about, could we use student AHPs? And initially we were thinking student speech therapists to carry out that as part of a placement. But as it happened, when we were at the point of being ready to go and we had patients ready to be interviewed and we'd gone through all our planning, we reached out to the universities, and as luck would have it, there were no students available to come on placement. It's typical, isn't it? But what there was two students from an OT course who were looking for a leadership placement. So that's who we eventually took to do this project as part of their leadership placement. Now, OT is not routinely used in the care of laryngectomies. And so this is a bit of an odd fit from our perspective. And we're like, not sure how this is going to go. And we certainly had to give a little bit more support than maybe we would have done to speech therapy students in terms of prepping them for meeting the patients, understanding their communication needs, particularly because we were going to be videoing and audio recording people, but we have people who communicate through communication aids, who mouth. You know, it's not all, you know, because they've had their voice taken away. Even those who do have surgical voice restoration, the quality of the voice isn't necessarily enough to pick up on the kinds of equipment that we've got access to, at least. So they were going to need extra support with how they were going to manage that. And we did give that to them. But what was really interesting was they went out, they did the interviews. We gathered 22 hours worth of video footage of patients and their loved ones talking about the whole pathway of the service. And those students then presented back to us about their experience of the placement. And whilst they've been listening to patients recount their stories and talk about their experiences, they still had their OT hats on. And so they were sitting there thinking, this stuff OT could do with this. Sounds very familiar to other populations that we would work with. So one of the students said, look, you know, the constellation of some of the issues that they're facing in terms of respiratory issues, fatigue, coping with a massive life change, this is really similar to people who have long COVID. And we're routinely working with people who have long COVID and support them in this and this and this way. And surely this might be helpful for this patient group as well. And as they were feeding it back to us as a group of very experienced AHPs, we all just sort of sat there and went, oh yeah, we really, really should have thought about this before. And as it happens, we then managed to find an OT in Nelft who works in palliative care and is willing to work with us to see if we can trial some OT intervention, particularly in those early stages post-surgery, to support people with that transition and managing their fatigue and rebuilding life and things like that. And then actually one of those students, for her part, has gone on to develop her final year project in an OT-led support group for people after laryngectomy. So it's kind of worked both ways in terms of sort of cross-fertilization. She's actually come back, so she decided to join us again for the patient staff feedback event. And she'll be joining us to present at some point, I think, as well. But so she's sort of stayed in touch and is taking that further forward. So I think that's really exciting and really unexpected.
It's a really wonderful example of innovation through multidisciplinary working, isn't it? And also practically, I think during the pandemic, you were just using whatever resources you had to do things. How did it go in terms of the event? So doing this during the pandemic, how did you manage? So there's usually a staff event and a patient feedback event and then a joint event, which is the first time that you bring everybody together and they get to watch the film, the Catalyst film, which is a 20 or 30 minute film that pulls out the main clips from that 22 hours worth of interviews. How did that go?
So we organised the staff event, but we had to think about, these are staff who are on the front line carrying out critical, you know, important visits to people with lived experiences. So we wanted to make sure that we did an event at a place and time that worked for staff as well. So we thought about having a face-to-face event. And because of how distributed the staff were and different things within that same day, we agreed that the best way to do this event was to facilitate it virtually. So we sent out the invites and we had a good turnout of staff. But another thing that we did, we knew that not all the staff will turn up on the day. So then we created an MS Teams link to allow those staff who were interviewed and staff who were part of that journey to also comment prioritizing those priorities too as well.
That's a great example of using a virtual platform to include people that aren't there at the time. Brilliant. And so what about the patient event? How did you manage that?
So the patient event, by this point, we were able to start meeting face-to-face, sort of COVID-wise. And it felt like the best way to do it because of people's communication needs. If you were trying to do something remotely, that would have caused real problems for a lot of our patients. So we looked at face-to-face and we were talking to the patients about it and promoting it with them and encouraging them to attend. But we looked at dates and times of the day and things that we thought would work best. We were actually asking them when might work best and trying to work it around that. But we also thought about other barriers that might be to attendance. So we thought about the location that we were choosing. So we chose to go with a third location so that it was a neutral site, so that you didn't have that power imbalance of patients coming onto a healthcare site and there being that difference between staff versus patients. So it's a neutral site that was close, or as close as we could, to where the majority of people lived to make it easier to get there. And we also managed to get agreement for funding for taxi transport for anyone who wasn't able to get there on their own. And then we sent out the invites. And in the end, only three people came to that event, which we were quite surprised given that so many people engaged with us with the interviews. And so we reached out to the patients to say, okay, why didn't you come? And the feedback was that they felt uncomfortable with the idea of communicating in a room full of people. So after having had that kind of surgery, they were concerned about their communication ability and having conversations with lots of people in the room. And so we sort of took that feedback on board. So when it came to the patient and staff event, we did the same thing in terms of where we hosted it and all the travel arrangements and things like that. But with the letter of invite, we were really explicit about understanding that people may have concerns around feeling sort of embarrassed or concerned about their communication issues in that kind of context. And we had planned for it, obviously. We are speech therapists, so we had planned for it in the patient event. We just hadn't communicated it to them. And so this time we communicated it. So we said, for a start, it's going to be a safe space. The only people at this event are going to be people who have had a laryngectomy, people who are loved ones of someone with a laryngectomy, or staff who directly work with people who have a laryngectomy. So there's going to be no outsiders here. Everyone's going to have an understanding of the surgery and what that means. And we know that people communicate in different ways and feel comfortable communicating in different ways. So we are thinking about that. So you'll be communicating mostly in small groups. No one's going to be asked to go and stand up and talk in front of 50 people. It'll be small groups for discussion. You will be able to write things down. You'll be able to communicate in whatever way you feel comfortable, and to as great an extent as you feel comfortable as well. If all you ever want to do in that meeting is sit, listen, and then write down your priorities for change, that's fine. That we're still getting your voice, and that's what we really want. And on that occasion, probably had 24-30 people, Patrick, somewhere around there.
Brilliant.
For that event. Overall, I did have a look at all the individuals who've been involved at any stage of the process so far, and so far we have captured over 70% of our patients within the project. So both the interviews, the patient event, and the patient and staff event, with over 70% of people that access the service have been involved at some stage.
Wow. That's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really good.
It was really good. It was really, really good. Really, I was just talking, I know we're kind of like in the joint event. So this is also where we shared the video. And it was really, really, really good when people, because I played the video, and I've seen the video a few times, and there were some of those videos I intentionally refused to see in advance because I wanted to experience the same thing with the room. And as the person presenting, I was facing facing everyone in the room, and just looking at the sort of the feedback expression that I was getting from the room, you could tell that something was happening in that moment. And there's this thing about where someone shares their experience in the video, So this was the staff who were seeing this for the first time as well. And some of the other people with lived experience in the room who didn't get the opportunity to be interviewed, and and just seeing everyone agreeing to some of the points that, you know, people raised. And I think we also had external people in the room who also appreciated the value of hearing firsthand. And talking about our hearing firsthand, personally, it was a lot of learning for me along the journey as well, because how nice would it be for a health service that keeps going back to check on people who use the service and saying, how about this? Why didn't you come on this day? What can we do to make it better? And I think there's a lot of positive and learning. Initially, I was thinking the big goal of all of this was at the end, you know, the celebration, once we've now put some change. It's only now that I'm starting to see that we're already making progress right from once we started to engage, communicate with people who use our services.
Did you have any issues with people not wanting to be filmed?
Not so much that. What we did do was change the consent form a little bit, I think, from the original one. Because, like you said, from a staff perspective, we were concerned. I mean, it's so drilled into us, isn't it, around confidentiality and not sharing any kind of patient identifiable information, and then you're showing somebody up on a screen.
That can't be anonymous.
So, you know, it's so drilled into us. And when we were looking at that consent form, some of it, I think, said, you know, it could be shared on social media and all these sorts of things. And I was like, I worry people will say no. And once people have said no, they're unlikely to then say yes. So we did adapt that form a little bit to say, actually, in this case, in terms of these in-depth interviews, we want people to be as open as possible with us so that we can learn as much as possible. We will only use these videos for the creation, you know, to analyze the information that's in them, to create this patient video that will be put together. We will actually come back and ask you for the sections that we want to use to make sure that you're comfortable, because, you know, often you've then got someone on camera saying that, yes, you have people on camera saying things that were really positive and that's great, but you've also got to have people on camera saying the things that didn't go well. So just to go back to people and say, look, these are the bits, you know, we will come back to you if we want to use your image for something and ask for separate consent for that. And then we did get a different consent. So when we had the patient and staff event, we did want to get some videos that we might want to show on social media of people talking about their experiences of being involved in EBCD. And on that occasion, we had a separate form that was very clear that we might use it on social media and things like that to show what we've been doing. So we've been careful about using different levels of consent for different aspects of it in order to help people to feel comfortable with the amount of information that they're sharing. So that was sort of how we approached it. I don't think nobody was interviewed who declined to be videoed. I don't know whether the prospect of being videoed prevented anyone from agreeing to being interviewed.
We also had to be aware that we're going into people's homes and we're trying to make it less intrusive as possible and very natural. So, and thinking around information governance around some of the information that we're collecting. So we had to use our own sort of encrypted trust laptop via Teams. And in which case we turned the video, the reflective video part off. So whilst the students were asking the questions, they were facing in the camera, but they'd already seen themselves back. It felt a bit more natural because our staff go into people's homes with our laptops anyway. And I think in hindsight, when we saw the quality of the videos, we could have gotten a lot better quality videos. Yeah. But this works for that situation with that client group. So I think that's one thing we had to do a lot of. We had to look at our client group to make some of the changes that would encourage more involvement and conversations.
Brilliant. And so then at the joint event, you showed the film. How was the reaction in the room of what happened?
I went to a few staff and I asked them, What were your thoughts, you know, when you looked at the video? And most of them said, these were not things that we weren't aware of, but it just sort of made a whole different meaning. Just hearing someone on camera talking about it. Some people who have never seen someone with a laryngectomy before had the opportunity to see some of the changes, the physical changes in that person on that video. And also appreciating that willingness to still want to speak. So we decided on something. So I was gonna share this only because it's gonna make me laugh. So when I came in that day for the joint event, we intentionally didn't give this project a name. Mm. We intentionally said, you know what, let's get information, let's find out what's important to our staff, to our people who use the services. So I came up with this very lengthy title because every presentation has to have a title. So SL, Speech and Language Therapy Co-Production Project Using the Experience-Based Core Design. Lengthy.
How many acronyms can you get in? Yeah.
it was really, and the moment we said, oh, Patrick, that's a lovely title. And then we thought to ourselves, we said, do you know what? How about we ask everyone in the room what the ideal name for this project should be? So at the end of the joint event, we did a little survey and we said, we want to give this project a name. Knowing what you know now and everything that we're trying to achieve, what would you call it? And someone wrote One Voice Project. And it was really significant because we're talking about people who have challenges using their voice and how we're able to give them a voice as part of this process. And I also interviewed some of the patients after the joint event to ask them what they thought about the day. And a lot of the feedback I got was, you hear people tell you a lot of the time, you know, get my feedback on this, get my feedback on that. But they felt really included. And when we even talked on the day about next steps in terms of running co-design groups, we had patients saying to us, we don't mind going to do some of the change ideas. I think one of them was training. And the patient said, well, I would love to train people myself because I've got the device on me, so I can train. There was no shortage of people wanting to be completely involved in this or completely co-designing. And I think that was really powerful because we didn't want a situation whereby we say, okay, thank you all for your feedback. We're now going to go and do it ourselves. And it was really nice that people were saying to us, pick me, choose me. I want to be part of this. I want to put in the change.
I think if we'd approached our patients before we started this process to say, Would you, we want to deliver some training to this group of professionals. Would you like to come and help us? I don't think we'd have had that many willing hands come up. I think people would have felt really self-conscious about it, anxious about it, and probably would have erred away from saying yes for various reasons. Whereas, as Patrick's saying afterwards, there were loads of people that came up and said, yeah, I want to do this. You know, if you want to go and train people, I'm happy to come along and be someone to talk about my experiences and show people my neck, and, you know, they can come and have a look. And I think the whole process of the co-production has led to increased engagement and confidence to be involved, I think, and comfort with it, and understanding that the information they're sharing will be treated with respect. Is not going to be abused in any way, and that we really do want them at the heart of it. This isn't, like Patrick was saying, it's not, yeah, thanks for your opinions, and now we're going to go off and do something about it. We want them to be continually involved, and that has really resonated, I think, and led to more people coming forward and saying, yeah, I want to be a part of this. It's really, really positive and really helpful for us.
What I'm really curious about, because we quite often hear issues around capacity. So with an EBCD project, it can take you 6 to 12 months potentially. And as you were saying, Rhiannon, quite often there's many offshoots, which is great because you get lots that comes out of it. But as a busy NHS service, how do you manage the capacity to do all of the things that needed to be done?
I think of the whole process, the interviews with patients, analysing those interviews, selecting the bits that needed to go into the video was probably the most time intensive bit, particularly if we were to run another project. I think, you know, there was a lot of time went into planning, but was possibly around the fact that we were doing it all for the first time. So actually, if you did another project, you go, oh, we know how to do this. We've done this before. Yeah. And it would flow that much more quickly. But I think gathering that, those videos would still be the most time intensive bit. And I think using the students was absolutely paramount to that. Without the students, we wouldn't have been able to do it. But I think it was a really good use of the students, and they got a lot out of it. Spending so many hours listening to people talking about their care, I think, is very valuable. It's not something that you get the chance to do normally as a student. So I think it still is a win-win, even though they weren't doing direct clinical work. So that's one thing. And then in terms of the actual QI projects, what we've tended to find, because we've had a long history in the team of training people through this facilitator training to do QI, and what we've typically found is that it doesn't really matter what the aim of the QI project is. It might be an aim that's reducing waiting lists or something like that, that's obviously around efficiency. But even if it isn't, normally one of the wins from the project will be efficiency. So where you're improving things, you normally save yourself time somewhere. So it's investing time to save time, and in the process ending up with a better quality service that staff can feel proud of. And I think that's another aspect to it as a manager, thinking about staff recruitment, staff retention. Almost when you're at your busiest and things are the hardest, you're most stretched, is when I feel like we need to release our staff to do these sorts of things, because it gives them power over an aspect of their work. Whereas otherwise you can just feel that you are swamped with waiting lists and stuff to do, and you're never getting to the bottom of it. So that feeling of helplessness within the system, I think, can then drive people to become burnt out, and then they leave and they go and do something else. Whereas, you know, I can't magic away those waiting lists. I can't make a lot of aspects less stressful. But by giving people control over this bit of the work that they're doing, and real autonomy to say, go do it. You're leading on this. This is your aim. We've agreed your aim. You achieve your aim how you feel is most appropriate. Then you're giving that staff member that autonomy and that control. And I think that then helps them to cope better with the stresses that come with the job. I think what this project did was challenge us to think about changing something that goes beyond our own team and our own service, because the issues like transition from hospital to home, this is a hugely complex service in terms of the number of specialties that are involved in caring for people who've had a laryngectomy. And so you are going to have to reach out beyond the trust, even, because it goes across multiple trusts. And so I don't think that's something that naturally, you know, you'd have gone, yes, that could be improved, but that's probably too bigger thing for us to chew, really. Let's keep it small. Whereas because you've got your patients in the room who have fed back en masse, this is an issue, this is a huge issue, it challenges you to go, okay, we kind of got to do something about this. we can't really ignore this. I think it taps in, I think as healthcare professionals, we all join our professions because we very much want to change things for people. And that is at the heart of what brings us all into our professions. And then we end up in the system and we get used to what we can actually achieve within the system that we're in. And you sort of go with that. And then when you're faced with very real patients in front of you saying, this isn't okay, we need this changed, it feeds back, it taps back into that original reason why you're here and gives you that energy and drive. And then, yes, the rationale, because if you need to go to people in senior management or something like that to get support for what you're trying to do, it's very hard for them to say no in the face of all of this patient feedback. You know, it really helps to support staff to do what I think the vast majority of us really, really want to do. But because of the system we're used to working in, we sort of lose that bit.
I was reflecting the other day, and it's only today I realized that we actually started this journey May of last year, really. It hasn't felt that long, to be honest. But some of these things are not quick. If you want to get really quality feedback from people who use service and involvement, it shouldn't be a quick exercise. And I think it's the case of just going on and starting it. And as you can see, I was thinking that the benefit was at the end. But I've learned so much in 1 month of even starting the project till now. To a certain degree, I don't even want it to end, because now I feel like the lessons that I'm learning from using this process are daily and monthly lessons. So I'm thinking, if this comes to an end, what's going to happen to all that learning I'm having? So really something that I've been learning quite a lot, informing my practice, informing how I support people through QI. Because we do talk about stakeholder engagement and quality improvement. We talk about engaging people who use services. But most of the time, sometimes what's missing is actually, rather than it being your agenda, how about it starts from the other way around? How about finding out from the people who you're making the change on, what is important to them, and working on that instead? And this is something new that we've infused into our QI trainings as well. And it's something that we're learning on.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Humanising Health and Care podcast. To find out more information about experience-based co-design, including our upcoming courses, please visit our website at pointofcarefoundation.org.uk. Thank you.